Stay tuned for Writers on Writing coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at kuci.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Good morning and welcome to this May 8th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and I'm doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. Onward with the show. Sigrid Nunez is with me this morning. She has published 7 novels, including A Feather on the Breath of God, The Last of Her Kind, Salvation City, and most recently, of course, The Friend. She is the author of Sempre Susan, a memoir of Susan Sontag. Her work has appeared in numerous journals and several anthologies, including 4 pushcart volumes and 4 anthologies of Asian American literature. One of her short stories has been selected this year for the Best American Short Stories 2019. Sigrid's honors and awards include a Whiting Writers Award, a Berlin Prize Fellowship, and 2 awards from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. The Friend, of course, won the 2018 National Book Award and was a finalist for the 2019 Simpson Joyce Carol Oates Prize. In addition to all of this, she has taught extensively at various universities and writing residencies. She was on the show with me in 2007 talking about The Last of Her Kind. Podcast of that show is out there on our site. But today, of course, we're chatting about The Friend. It is published by Riverhead Books, and it is now out in paperback. Sigrid, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank
you for having me.
Thanks for coming back. You wouldn't know this, but you were my second ever interview on the radio 12 years back. And you were, and I was a nervous wreck, and you were so kind and so patient with my nervous wreckedness. So anyway, It's nice to have you back. Thank you for coming back on.
Okay.
So I wanted to sort of start out before we dive into The Friend and talk about kind of now that there are 7 novels and there are so many short stories and the book about Susan Sontag. I was just wondering if, as you look back across the arc of all of this work, sort of what are the things that you find that don't leave you alone, and what things do you see as new obsessions? Like, it seems like animals and relationships with animals have kind of endured across time, but I'm kind of wondering if you feel like your work tracks your own life stages. Do you find yourself sort of grappling with similar issues at different angles, or do new things concern you as time moves on?
I think it's more that, it's both, actually. I mean, new things do concern me as time moves on, including, for example, getting older, but there are just certain obsessions that have always been there. It's been said, that pretty much all writers have like 1 or 2 obsessions, and that they basically keep writing those out for their whole careers. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So I've always been interested in people who are in some kind of extreme condition. So I've written about a nurse during the Vietnam War, and I've written about people in prison and struggling immigrants, and in this latest book about someone dealing with extreme grief. And with coping with suicide loss. And I've always also been very interested in memory and in how, all our lives, all your life, your mind is blending memory and imagination to create this narrative that could be called my life. And, you know, and I've always been interested in how what happens in the past, particularly childhood, shapes the adult and how the adult sees the world. And I see these concerns in all my work from the beginning. For example, in this last book, a lot I write about reading and writing and teaching writing, you know, and how I have certain ideas about that have come because I've been doing that for so many years.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because before I read the novel, I was sort of led to think this is really a relationship about a woman and a dog, and a woman and her friend who had committed suicide, which it is. But because of my own areas of concern, I really loved this as a writing book and as a writer and as somebody thinking about writing and all of those things. And so I really appreciated all the wonderful sort of writing advice and insights you've had into maybe teaching and MFAing. And can you talk a little bit more about that sort of your thoughts about MFAs and teaching and writing? There's some advice in here about, you know, if you can do anything else besides writing, you should. And I was kind of wondering if that is where you come down on that, because I know writing has been a lifelong obsession of yours, and sort of how you feel about that, and if your feelings about it have changed over time at all.
Well, I think the suggestion that if you can do anything else with your life besides writing, you should do that. That is a quote in the book. It's the mentor, the friend, who says that to the narrator. It's not the narrator's idea. But I did take that from life, because it was something that my first writing teacher, Elizabeth Hardwick, when I was in college and I took two workshops with her, she used to say that to us. And I think really where it comes from is that there does seem to be an idea that writing and having a life as a writer are a lot easier than they in fact are. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, you're teaching, you're in a program, of course you don't want to be discouraging, because there's no reason for you to be discouraging. Many people become writers, and very successful ones. But there does, you know, you do run up against this thing, which can be frustrating, of people thinking that they just need to sit down and write it, you know, like once, maybe polish it a little bit. And, you know, that just isn't true. It really takes a lot of work, and it's a very lonely kind of work, because even though you might belong to a class and a community and a program and have friends that you show your work to and have family that supports you, you know, ultimately it is a very lonely life. I mean, things have changed now, but, you know, there are good reasons why, you know, back in the day it was rare to meet a writer who wasn't an alcoholic, mm-hmm. or at least who didn't abuse alcohol. And the suicide rate among writers is higher than among other groups. And that's something that I did want to talk about in the novel. But I think as far as a big change that I see now that, you know, is of course very troubling and would be to any writer, is that back when I was a student in an MFA program, it was, you know, you took it for granted that one of the reasons why the student wanted to be a writer was because that student loved literature and loved reading. And now it is far from uncommon to meet an aspiring writer who says that they don't want to read. In fact, they don't like reading. They don't have really any interest in literature, but they want to be a writer anyway. That is very difficult to work with.
Really?
And I don't really, you know, understand it, because it's so different from the way I saw things and still see things. And so there's that. And then also then, you know, there was, as I recall, when I was young, there really was an emphasis on this idea that, you know, that writing was a vocation, and that you should think of it as a vocation, as I was taught by people, you should be thinking of it as a vocation and not as a career. And now you'll find a lot of students in writing programs for whom it's sort of seen as more of a lifestyle that they're looking for. And one of the reasons why they want to be a writer is because they think it has a certain kind of life that will not only be enjoyable, but will lift their self-esteem. And, you know, I think about, you know, what somebody like Philip Roth would say is that, you know, how frustrating writing is. It's like baseball. You fail two-thirds of the time. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end of his life saying, I just can't do it anymore. I just can't face this failure all the time. That is very familiar to any professional writer. As I say again, you don't want to be discouraging, but, you know, there has to be an understanding of that. And, you know, and I meet a lot of aspiring writers who have an idea that it's just another activity that they can do if they really want it and if they have a good story or think they have a good story, that everything will fall into place. Whereas the truth is that there is so much failure and rejection in any writer's life that you really do have to be quite strong, and you have to be doing it for other reasons than success. You have to be doing it because it gives you something. It's a process that rewards you in other ways than in the conventional ways of being recognized, being published, making money.
I'm sort of sitting here stunned because I guess I'm so out of tune with this younger generation of writers that I hadn't heard any of this. I'm kind of stunned into silence. But do you think this result is from sort of the selfie, social media, iPhone generation, that my story is more important to tell than the vast body of literature already out there is important to read? Like, do you think this is a really narcissistic approach to writing that's happening now?
Well, it isn't. I don't know how much social media, you know, has affected it, because it was something that I saw before that. I mean, it was there before that. So I don't know. There's, you know, we live in a culture where, you know, there's a certain kind of emphasis on individual expression and on the idea of you creating your own lifestyle in a way, as I said. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, you know, think that they can, that's what it would mean to be a writer, is, as I say, to have a certain lifestyle, and that can take you down a very wrong road.
Right. My guest this morning is Sigrid Nunez. The book is The Friend, of course. So let's dive into the novel itself. It's a lot of things. It's a novel of friendship. It's a novel of suicide, as we mentioned. It's sort of the fraught terrain of friendship between a man and a woman, one of whom is often married. It's about writing and writers and mentorship and a bond between a woman and a Great Dane. And it's sort of a form between somewhere between diary and love letter and kind of meditation and novel. And I still feel like I'm not doing it justice. So I want to kind of give you a chance to talk about kind of how you talk about The Friend and how you introduce the book.
Well, it might be helpful to talk about how I, you know, how I had the idea of writing it in the first place, you know, how it came to get started. You know, I needed to write something short because the Boston University faculty was giving its annual faculty reading, and there were several of us, so we were all reading for, you know, under 10 minutes, and I wanted to read something new. Of course, it didn't have to be something complete, so I just sat down. I had something on my mind. I just started writing a few pages, and that's what I read, and I liked the response that I got to those. And then I knew that shortly after I was going to be reading at the University of Maryland, and they wanted about 25 minutes, and I thought, well, let's just go on with this. And by the time I'd written those pages, I knew that I had something that could turn into a book. But there were several things going on in my head, which then ended up being what the book was about. And one was this idea of people I knew personally, who I knew were thinking about suicide as something that might happen to them in their lives. They weren't, they weren't at the point of doing it. They weren't crying for help, but it had come up in conversation. I knew that several of them thought this may very well be how my story ends. And then one of those people actually did end up committing suicide. I had finished the book by that time. I also, as I said before, I'd spent so many years, reading, writing, teaching writing, that I would like to have a place where I could include some of that material in something I was writing. Then this passion for animals that I've had since I was a little kid, I've always wanted to write a book that would have as a main character an animal, particularly a dog. And then I had been trying to write something about a story about sex trafficked women, which was not working out, which I was really having kind of writer's block trying to make progress with it. And there were various reasons for that, and I thought I would like to make that part of my story too. So there were all these threads that I thought, well, if I continue in this particular form that I had found, where I could move from one to the other and braid them together and find links among them, that I'd be able to include all of these, and that turned out to work out.
It really feels like a novel where you knew all the rules very well, and then you sort of played with them or broke some of those rules with such elegance. Like, we're always told as writers, don't write a novel in the second person, or,
That's true, but that's actually a misunderstanding. It's not in the second person. A novel in the second person would be a novel that uses you, where the you is really the narrator.
Right, right.
You wake up in the morning, meaning I wake up in the morning. It's the main character. So it's not in it's in the first person, the novel. It's not in the second person. But there are times in the novel, particularly when it starts out, where the narrator is addressing a you.
Correct. Right.
So there's that, and I have seen second person novels done very well, and other ones not done so well. So some people break that rule, just fine. Though I haven't. But speaking of that, did I want to sit down and write a novel about a writer? No. Certainly not. I had reservations. My editor had reservations. Anyone would have reservations about writing a book about a writer. That's another thing that you're told. Don't do that.
Right.
But as it turned out, I did not plan for this narrator to be a writer. As things developed, I realized that she has a certain way of thinking and observing the world that only a writer would have.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no way around that, I wanted to talk about teaching writing. Obviously, she would have to be a writer. So that was very interesting because setting out thinking about it, I would never have said, "Oh, I'm going to write a novel about a writer and writing."
Right, right. If you were, you do a lot of teaching, and I wonder what you sort of. Kind of how you approach that, because in the book, there is some not indictments, but there are some commentary on teaching and writing and MFAs and workshops and whatnot. And I'm kind of wondering how you approach the writing workshop, what you tell students, how you guide them through this difficult terrain, and just talk about kind of your approach to teaching them.
Well, I think largely editorial. And in that sense, I, you know, when people say, oh, but writing can't be taught, we know what they're talking about. They're saying you can't put talent into somebody if it isn't there. Well, that might be very true. But it's also true that you can see people, and not just young people, people of all ages, can be writing something at a certain point in their lives, which is really very bad. There's really nothing good about it, frankly. And then at a certain point, maybe weeks later, months later, a year later, years later, that person can produce something astonishing. Now, I have seen that many, many times. Therefore, that makes that part of my teaching easy. I treat everybody as if they have the same extraordinary potential, because I don't know, because you cannot tell. You cannot tell what a person is capable of in the future.
Hmm.
This is really very, very true, and other teachers and writers know it too. And then it seems to me, you know, what we do in the workshop, all of us together, is, as I say, it's editorial. It's not me saying, I think you should write about this, I don't think you should write about that, why don't you write a different story? You know, I'm more interested in just going over it, you know, line by line, page by page, and talking about what works and what doesn't work. You know, and I think it's pretty straightforward.
So is that a suggestion that it's less about talent and more about time at task and perseverance, do you think?
Well, I don't, you know, I think that, you know, obviously, you know, Flannery O'Connor is right. You know, you have to have a gift. You have to have talent, and you have to have a story, and you have to have the willingness to work really hard to make that story a good one. But as I say, as far as the talent goes, it's not like musical talent. It doesn't necessarily manifest at the age of five, as, you know, as happens with certain, you know, great musicians. It might not happen until, you know, midlife. You know, you could be a perfectly, you know, average or less than average student in the workshop in college and in an MFA program, and then somehow, you know, you find what you need. You hone your skills, and you find your voice, and you know what you want to write about, and you come up with something really good. As I say, I see this happen all the time.
Mm-hmm. And you should read. I think.
And you should read. Well, that's the other thing. I mean, that's the other thing that I try to, you know, emphasize. You know, read, read, read. I always say the workshop is all well and good, but you will learn more from reading other writers than you ever will from any workshop.
Right, right. And who are those writers that you really push upon your students?
I don't push any particular ones. I say, you know, you have to find someone whose work you read it, you know, and even if their work is very different from what you're doing, you read their work and you say, yes, I want to get something of this into my own work.
Right.
This is what makes me want to write, this particular writer. And then read everything of that writer. And then you just keep finding writers like that who are basically inspiring, who make you want to write. Really, I think it's that. But that would be different people. You know, I often start out in the first workshop going around the room saying, okay, tell me, who are your people? By which I mean not necessarily your major influences, your favorite writer or models, but just, you know, who do you go to when you want to read something to make you happy or excited or whatever? Who are those people? And it's always very different people, and it's often people, as I say, who the student does not write like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody very far from that student's concerns, but nevertheless, it's a writer that's beloved to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was other good advice in here about walking, and I do think that walking, the movement of the body with the mind not being occupied by other things, is actually really very helpful to writers. It's helpful to generate ideas. It's helpful to work out problems. I don't know if you personally use that as a method of sort of unlocking things that you're struggling with, but your your narrator.
I do. Yeah, I do. I do think walking is a very, very good thing to do. You know, you could be writing and then you stop and then you go out and walk, but you have to leave your phone home.
Mm-hmm.
And most people aren't willing to do that.
Right. Or leave your phone generally when you're writing. I think that's just become such a massive distraction to people.
Right.
Although you're walking in New York, so it probably takes some degree of attention to stay focused when you're walking in New York that you probably wouldn't get unless you're walking in Central Park or something.
Or I would, when I'm not in New York, which does happen too, I would prefer to be walking in the woods than walking in New York.
Yeah, yeah. Did the book change your mind about anything, or were you even looking forward to do that, or did it, you know, answer any questions for you that you set out to answer for yourself, or is that really not the job of the book to do for you?
Nothing that I can think of in particular.
Yeah. What was the biggest struggle what was the biggest challenge that was presented to you by it, and if you can talk about kind of pushing through that?
I think the biggest struggle was, you know, what I said at the beginning, you know, trying to make the different things that I was writing about connect rather than have it be a collage of different stories. You know, I really wanted them to be all, you know, related, these four major ideas that I had. You know, in some cases that came very naturally, and in other cases I wasn't sure about I was sure about the structure. I had the structure I wanted, but I wasn't absolutely sure about the chronology, as it were. I wasn't, you know, when I was going to be in the past or the present, and which section should follow from another section. That was the biggest struggle, probably.
Right, right. I'll say that I both read the novel and I listened to the novel, and those mm-hmm. two experiences were really very different. I really recommend that to people approaching this book, that hearing it, I don't know, for whatever reason, I haven't really sat down to psychoanalyze it, but for whatever reason was a very different experience than sitting down to read it. Both
That's interesting.
Very pleasurable and both very different from each other. So take that for what it's worth. I don't know. We're out of time. Should we have mentioned anything that we didn't mention?
Not that I can think of.
Any other big advice that you give your students or writers that we didn't get a chance to talk about, or did we talk about it all?
Well, recently in a class that I've been teaching, I've been quoting Virginia Woolf from A Room of One's Own, where, you know, she says, you should write what you want to write. And whether it's for an hour or for eternity is not for you to say.
Right. That's great advice. Whatever calls to you is, yeah. Sigrid Nunez,
yes.
This was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was Sigrid Nunez, the author. The book is The Friend. It's out and available now in paperback. We're going to take a very short break. Please stay with me. Amanda Marbet will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We're under College Radio. We're under Writers on Writing. I don't even know what I'm talking about. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads. And information on speaker series, which there is one coming up next week. So check that out. Steve Rowley will be there next week, which is really, really cool. Onward with the show. Amanda Marbet's writing has appeared in Joyland, Fail Better, the Dr. T.J. Eckelberg Review, and Paste Magazine. Claiming a Body won the Short Fiction Award from Moon City Press this year. It's published by Moon City Press, and we're going to chat about it this morning. Amanda, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. Everybody knows on the show, I love the short story form. Love, love, love the short story form. And I love talking about the short story form.
That's great. Not everyone does.
I know. And I don't know why. So I'm here to change people's ways. So before we dive in, I'm going to let you talk about the collection, talk about Claiming a Body, kind of the collection as a whole, and you know what was on your mind, how it came together, and kind of the various themes that unite these stories to make it into a collection.
Okay, well, in a nutshell, I would say that this book it's largely set in the Midwest, so all the characters are in that Midwestern area for the most part, except for, I think, one story. And these characters, they're kind of struggling with kind of disintegrating middle class, and there's some issues with farming, some ethical issues, and then there's also some issues with addiction. But they are not characters to be pitied. They're a little bit, I think they've been called gritty, and I think that's fair. And they certainly kind of treat their circumstances with a little bit of levity and humor and sometimes a little absurdity. So they are kind of getting through it. They're down, but they're not out. So that's a little bit, a few of them are I would classify them as literary crime stories.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, at least three are that way.
Yeah. And 9 of the 11 were published in literary journals before the collection came together. And talk a little bit about that process, about submitting and, you know, knowing when the story was done, when to let it go. And then once it was published, I don't know if it changed at all before it was added back into the collection. Some stories seem to morph even after they're out there.
Question. Yeah, so basically, these stories were written over a 6-year period for the most part. And one of them, the last story, actually, funny enough, the first story in the collection is the latest one I wrote, and the last in the collection is the oldest story.
That's funny.
And that story is from 2009, so that's like definitely the oldest one. And the rest kind of took place in that 6-year period.
Okay.
But I did. I published these stories before I put them in a collection and submitted them to a lot of contests, actually, for publication as a unit. And I think I just kind of, I read a lot of literary journals, so they were places that kind of I felt interested in, and I read a lot of their work. So I was like, oh, I would be really honored, you know, to have this story this place or in this journal or that journal. So, you know, over time, just placing them in different places, different journals is kind of how that came about. They did change after the book was accepted. In a few spots, I had a couple authors weigh in and say, hey, what about this and that? And there were a few small changes that I did make, which was actually kind of fun for me to revisit these characters.
Yeah, it is interesting. Once a story is out there and it kind of has a life of its own and it's now interacting with readers, to take another look at it and say, and especially when it's interacting with the stories in a collection as opposed to just standing on its own. I think it can shape-shift and morph a little bit, and you know. So not all stories belong in a collection. So talk a little bit about that, too. And, you know, if there were 85 stories and you had to choose the 11 that really spoke to each other, or if your kind of natural area of concern was just around, you know, where these stories ended up.
Well, I think the ones that got cut, in large part, were the flash fiction pieces. I had a lot of flash fiction, and I still kind of go back and forth to this longer, what I would call 3,000-word form, or 3 to maybe 4,500, tends to be what I come in at, or 500 to 1,000 words. So I cut the flash pieces out, and I think mostly because they sort of relied a little more on lyricism, and I didn't think that hit kind of tonally the right spot for the rest of the stories.
Mm-hmm. You, as you alluded to before, the setting of this collection is almost as important of a character as any of the characters are. I mean, the settings are in all of these stories are just so very visceral. And talk about whether you lived in these places, whether it's, because sometimes I think it's interesting to think about if you live in a place, if it's easier to write about, or if you need distance from a place, and what that distance from geography gives you perspective-wise of what you're writing about, and just kind of how you thought about setting, if you thought about it as a character, and kind of how you grappled with it.
Yeah, setting is very important for these stories, and I think they kind of shape each of the characters to some degree. They're shaped by their surroundings, and they're also shaped by something I probably would want to talk about a little later, is they have this sort of universal reference point of TV and film. Sort of they kind of borrow their identities from from film. There's a lot of film references.
Mm-hmm.
But with regard to landscape, they're kind of struggling with that landscape. So I think the characters have a lot of concern for environmental issues, as I do myself. But in terms of living in the area, for all except two, I lived in whatever state or even city that it takes place in. And the two that I didn't live in was for Buried. I've not lived in North Dakota. I've done hiking and there in Montana. But that story was sort of born from, I did work for a company that helped build hotels, and so a construction company. And so it was kind of born out of that construction boom that happened in Williston around the time that fracking really was taking hold. So they have a germ of whatever was interesting to me, but I didn't necessarily live in the area for all of the stories. Oh, and 14er, my husband's from Colorado, so we go there a lot. So that kind of sunk into me just by virtue of family. So
yeah, interesting. So talk about the film. Talk about how movies and film sort of informed these.
Yeah, so I noticed that I know this is a theme I'm drawn to often. I feel like for these characters, if there was any kind of void in their life where they were trying to figure out who they were as a person, they had kind of this worldview and this personal integrity, but they also had this kind of who am I? I'm like the celebrities I see on TV and in film. And I don't know that they necessarily want that, but they certainly use it as a shorthand to communicate with each other and to think about their circumstances. And I'm not suggesting that they don't have anything else going on. It's more or less that they're asking themselves, where do I fit in the world? And they sometimes attach to those characters in film and TV rather than sort of thinking about, maybe they don't even want to look at where they are in life right now. And I think for the character Brett, you know, in Faker, he is sort of pulling away from that. He's kind of like, what's the difference between the world I'm living in right now? What do I want to take away from it, and what am I sort of rejecting from it? So he's pulling away from that fantasy, but a lot of the characters kind of compare themselves to TV and film characters.
Was that a surprise to you? I mean, at what point in the stories did you have that observation? At what point in writing the stories?
It was a surprise. I watch a lot of TV and film myself, not as much as I read, but pretty close. And I know it creeps into my teaching a lot, as sort of making these references to kind of bring them into narrative, visual narrative as well as written narrative. And, you know, I was being honest with myself that it is very important to me. And I think that it was creeping into the stories, but it wasn't until well into the collection being put together that I was like, wow, these are in each one of these stories. There's a small bit of it in each one, to the point where in Werewolf DNA, her boss, he has a terrible boss situation, Regina does, right. And her boss names her Nico, and that's music, of course, but she's not even the person that she is to her boss. She's this famous person, so. And she, of course, doesn't particularly like that.
Right.
So, yeah.
Oh, you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm chatting with Amanda Marbe. The book is Claiming the Body. So I would love to do a little fast MFA program by Amanda for the next few minutes.
Yeah.
And we had talked about choosing one of these stories that we can really dissect and get into and talk about maybe one of them that gave you difficulty or one of them that surprised you. And we're going to take it kind of from your very initial kernel of the idea with the blank cursor on the page to the final product and you know, if it was even recognizable to you once it came out the other end. What story should we do?
I think the story that probably surprised me the most was Faker.
Perfect, yeah.
When I first started that, I had more of an idea that I wanted to write about this character who was helping his dad with the chicken farm, but that he was frustrated by sort of the brutality of the battery cages, and his dad is kind of cutting some corners and not properly disposing of the waste, and he has these large lagoons. So that's where it started, but it didn't really end up there. The characters kind of took a life of their own, so I went with it. And so now it became this kind of character where this Brett, he is working for his dad, but he's also cheated on his girlfriend. And these very minor situations that happen in high school become really big. They become outsized because – and the story actually became what I think, going back to it, when I was doing the galleys and then you know, I was reading back through it again. I was like, this story is actually really scary.
Yeah.
Zoe has this plan to really hurt this other character that her boyfriend has cheated on her with, and she's trying to implicate the boyfriend in it. And so it kind of got me thinking about how teenagers have these sort of strong emotions but no impulse control. And so what they don't think they can hurt someone else, but they're actually more powerful than they think. And so as that story sort of evolved and I let her kind of go where she was going to go and Brett deal with it the way he was going to, I was surprised it became as deeply a crime story as it did.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly liked the way that it came out. It had real moments of absurdity, I think, and of the situation itself, of taking something so small that these characters are concerned with and getting so upset about them,
mm-hmm.
about it.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, I liked the way it ended up.
Yeah. How many revisions did it go through?
Oh, man, I would say on average, it's hard to say. I've at least 25, I would say.
There you go.
The last story I wrote had 40 revisions. So okay. I personally am a fan of revision. I think most writers
good thing, yeah.
are, but yeah, good thing. When does a story finish? I know it's a question that's often asked, and kind of for me, never.
Uh-huh.
If I could keep changing something, I recognize that a story has done what it's supposed to do or that it's gotten to a point where you can cut it off, but tinkering is a thing that I'm always drawn to because, you know, there's always a line here or a line there that you might want to change.
That's the mark of a writer. I mean, you know, I think, yeah, the really good writers have a very hard time letting go, and you can always see places where you could, yeah, you're right, you could tweak it or say something slightly different. I think that one of the really hard parts for a short story, well, for any writer, I suppose, is the getting in and the getting out. And can you talk a little bit either about this story or any of the other stories, kind of framing the story? I think this is particularly hard in short stories because it's so compressed and you don't have that much time. And so the
yeah.
getting it and the getting out, I think, is really tricky. Can you kind of talk about finding a story's beginning and end? I know that's a really broad question, but...
No, but it's a good question. I think that it's very hard to compress all the ideas that you may have to begin with in a short story, and I find that initially when I left my MFA program, I would write pages and pages and pages and try to find sort of those great moments, which I think was advice we got in MFA programs, and strip it out and make a story from that, which I still do that, but I think I have more of a shape that tends to evolve around draft, you know, whatever, 10 or 15. But I can say because the short story form for me is so brief and compressed that I've had a number of instances where I've written a story and stripped out three or four different stories from it. I'm like, well, I'm really actually writing three stories here.
Hmm.
So, you know, pull those sections out and see if they can become anything later is something that I've done. And I embrace that process because I think also it tends to be that if I have two or three stories in the same story, they're going to have some thematic resonance.
Do you give yourself constraints around the short story form? Like, do you give yourself sort of parameters or restrictions? I find a lot of interesting writing comes out when I give myself either a prompt or I make myself, like in flash fiction pieces, restricted to a certain word count or something. Interesting things sort of happen when you put governors on your story. And I don't know if that's a technique you use at all.
Yeah, I do. I would say I probably use it more often with flash fiction, but I do use it even in longer form if only to say that the story is going to be 3,000 words and I, you know, that's the point at which I'm going to kind of shape it. But
yeah.
Constraint-based, for sure, yeah. For flash fiction, I'll say, I want this to be a story about, so for the last story of this collection, I wanted it to be a... quest or a travel short story, but I didn't want it to be a traditional in its storytelling in that it goes through a progressive series of obstacles that the character has to go through.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I wanted it to be this interior journey while they're actually taking this exterior journey in a very overt way. So I think that story is a little more self-aware. So yeah, I definitely do. Often it's with genre. Like, is this going to be crime story or a quest story or whatever.
Right, right. I also wanted to mention your dialogue is so strong. And in the acknowledgement section at the beginning, you mentioned something about the importance of reading your work out loud. And I don't know if those two things are in conversation with each other, but your dialogue is knockout. And I was wondering if you had any advice on strong dialogue.
Dialogue is my absolute favorite thing to write. In fact, I have written whole stories first just writing the dialogue. And then going in and saying, okay, what else is happening here, and writing my action. So dialogue first and then action. And I think sometimes, too, since I like to write dialogue, I really enjoy humorous dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I kind of have to strike a balance between how funny is this going to be with some serious subject matter, because I have a lot of gallows humor. So sometimes I'll say this character needs a little more interiority, or they're going to sound really glib. So that's something I kind of go back and address. But I think first and foremost, I just enjoy writing dialogue. If I just sit there and write it, that would be the thing that I would go for and do first. I'm sorry, what was the second part of that question?
You're reading aloud and whether that...
Oh, reading aloud, yeah. But dialogue is virtually impossible to do at a reading, in my opinion. I feel like it's hard to keep an audience engaged when you're reading dialogue, just one person reading it. So I tend to read flash pieces almost universally for readings. But at the same time, I did read that the piece in here, Horribilist, that was in Electric Literature, I did read that for a reading, and there is a decent amount of dialogue in that. But the sort of the feedback I got from so much laughter on such a very dark issue as trauma was really pleasing to me, because I realized that people weren't going to be afraid to sort of have that safety valve of humor. They weren't going to be afraid to laugh, even though this was such serious material, because I often like to deal with trauma after the fact rather than the trauma during when it happens, because so many people have survived trauma. I'm interested in that segment of the population that has moved on with their lives, but it still affects them. So, reading aloud is great for that, gauging the audience's response and what they think of it.
It kills me that we're out of time, but I'm so glad that you mentioned A, the gallows humor, and B, the trauma after the fact. All of those are really, we didn't get enough chance to talk about the humor in this book, but it's, I love gallows humor too. So it was wonderful for me, and the whole collection is wonderful. So tell us where we can find you online and follow you more.
I do have a Twitter presence that is small, and I need to put more time into that. And with writing, you're always like, do I write more or do I push this more? But then I do have a website, and then on Facebook there is a page that you can go to for the book itself that'll have readings announced, and reviews will be on that. So Facebook is a good place to go to if you're interested in news on the book. And of course, you can get it at University of Arkansas Press. And where books are sold, a lot of other outlets.
Amanda Marmbase, thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. The book, Claiming the Body, out and available now. Wonderful collection of short stories. That's all the time we have for Available this week. Stay tuned for more awesome programming, some great music coming up next, and we will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.